From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Donald Trump campaign is cratering, but evidently it's not his fault.
The election is being rigged by corrupt media pushing completely false allegations and outright lies in an effort to elect her president.
Please. Obviously sour grapes and a figment of a demented imagination. Except for the part of it that's true. I know at least one journalist who back during the primaries begged his colleagues to gang up against the surging Trump.
Every interview with Donald Trump, every single one, should hold him accountable for bigotry, incitement, juvenile conduct, and blithe contempt for the Constitution. The voters will do what the voters will do, but it must not be, cannot be, because the press did not do enough.
Back in May, I was agitating for the media to cover the election not like the usual horse race, but like an approaching killer storm, to document his hate speech and debunk his lies. Not, pointedly, to go easy on Hillary Clinton, but to meticulously rake the endless Trump muck, because at stake was our very democracy. Much journalistic eye-rolling ensued, but after Trump won the Republican nomination, the coverage did get more hostile. News stories and analysis called out the lies. Columnists and editorialists raged against him. The same media that built Trump's 24/7 publicity platform turned it into a gallows, if only by quoting his words and reporting facts.
3 a.m. tweets and an obsession with the 1996 Miss Universe.
He bought a portrait of himself with tax-deductible money.
And when Hillary Clinton accused him of paying no income tax during Monday's debate, Trump said, quote, that would make me smart.
Again, obviously, the same press has also dutifully covered Clinton's emails, Goldman Sachs speeches, trade deal flip-flops, and the Clinton Foundation to a fare-thee-well. But certainly, they buried Trump. And now, through the courtesy, it seems, of Vladimir Putin and WikiLeaks, we learn of an apparently cozy relationship between political reporters and the Clinton campaign. In the WikiLeaks dump, reporters from the New York Times and Politico were revealed to have allowed the campaign to choose which quotes from otherwise off-the-record conversations would be permissible to publish. Politico's Glenn Thrush submitted whole story passages about campaign chairman John Podesta to John Podesta for review, noting mordantly in an email, quote, because I have become a hack, I will send you the whole section that pertains to you. Please don't share or tell anyone I did this. Sad. But despite Trump's paranoid accusations, this doesn't really constitute collusion. It's merely an infuriatingly common and completely bipartisan inside the Beltway game of trading deference for access. And it's also indefensible, giving story subjects the opportunity to shape and soften the coverage. No scoop is worth the surrender of journalistic independence. As observed in 2012 on this program by UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism Dean Edward Wasserman.
I think at this point, you're no longer talking about an interview, you're talking about a press release. And what happens is Washington becomes no different from Beijing in terms of reporting what authorities want reported.
I personally am prepared to defend my anti-Trump crusade as a rare historic necessity in the face of a 100-year storm. Even New York Times executive editor Dean Baquet has said that Trumpery forced journalists to recalibrate how we deal with politicians' naked lies. But when business as usual becomes Exhibit A in the accusation of media collusion, it's high time to change business as usual. Turns out that not only did Trump not introduce the notion of a rigged system to this election cycle did not introduce it to political debate.
People feel like the system is rigged against them. And here's the painful part. They're right. The system is rigged.
Millions of Americans are giving up on the political process because they understand the economy is rigged.
While there is zero basis for any claim of a stolen election or even a manipulated one, it may be worth recalling that democracy and equity are not the same thing. Emily Bazelon wrote, "Is the election rigged?" over the summer for the New York Times Magazine. She's noted that the word itself has had a special power.
There is, if you're on the left, a kind of righteous wielding of this battle cry from Bernie Sanders, from Elizabeth Warren, which is talking about the ways in which, as Warren would say, the kind of fat cats on Wall Street are getting hidden benefits that other people don't get. Warren, importantly, was involved in starting the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And Bernie Sanders, you know, with his kind of quasi-socialist message, is talking about an idea about rigging that has to do with who benefits from our tax dollars and from the way the government is run, and does too much of that benefit go to a very small number of people?
Regrettably, we must now move on to Trump. He isn't really talking about a system contaminated over time to pervert true democracy. He's alleging an active conspiracy involving voter fraud and media collaboration with his opponent, Hillary Clinton. But that's really just a distillation of his whole raison d'etre for running, that the real America is being stolen from you. The difference in this charge, is it just a question more of degree than of substance?
I think that's right. I was talking to a Trump supporter this week who said that what he meant by the election being rigged is that a whole demographic, by which I think he meant people of color, they're all supporting Democrats. And so the only explanation was that the system was rigged in some way that favored them. They were getting paid off. He didn't actually mean that the party was paying them to go to the polls, but he did have some notion that what I think of as just straightforward, people vote for the candidate who they think will benefit them. To him, this seemed very sinister, but only on the Democratic side. And there's some kind of deeper set of suspicions there about America and the way it's changing that I think Trump is really tapping into.
In the way that demagogues are wont to do, and not for the first time. Back in 1968, Nixon was the candidate for the Republicans, Hubert Humphrey for the Democrats. But there was a third party prospective spoiler in there, George Wallace, the segregationist governor of Alabama. What did he have to say?
Listen to this. George Wallace said, "They lie when they poll. They are trying to forge public opinion in the country, and professional polls are owned by Eastern moneyed interests, and they lie. They're trying to rig an election." And that's very familiar to us now from Trump, who's also been talking about an international banking conspiracy that is kind of code for anti-Semitic tropes from the past. And then again, this idea that the election itself is not going to be fair.
Then there's Clinton, who recently has begun occasionally to mouth the word. Why was she so cautious about it? And why is her rhetorical strategy shifting a bit?
She's come around recently because she's trying to appeal to Sanders voters and to show that she does understand the ways in which working class and poor Americans and middle class Americans feel sold out. Hillary Clinton prefers more calibrated and abstract language. She tends to say the deck is stacked.
American families have basically done whatever it took to make it work. But I think it's fair to say that as you look across the country, the deck is still stacked in favor of those already at the top. And there's something wrong with that.
There's a kind of cautionary note to sound here, too, I think. You know, President Obama did use the word rigged a little bit on the campaign trail in 2008. Then he kind of moved away from it. And by his final State of the Union this past January, he was really in a different kind of mood. Obama said, "Democracy breaks down
when the average person feels their voice doesn't matter. That the system is rigged in favor of the rich or the powerful or some special interest. Too many Americans feel that way right now. It's one of the few regrets of my presidency, that the rancor and suspicion between the parties has gotten worse instead of better."
An August Gallup survey found that 62% of those surveyed believe that their vote will be accurately counted. Now that means that 38% aren't entirely confident, which strikes me as pretty fundamental.
That number does seem really high. I wonder if some of it can be attributed to the kind of lingering memory of Bush versus Gore. The questions about counts and recounts and hanging chads in Florida really did call our basic mechanics of voting into question. And then you see what Donald Trump is doing. This is, I think, what we keep returning to with this word rigged. There's always some way in which there are problems with the system, and maybe it can be rigged, or maybe it was once rigged. And then you have to somehow figure out what's real and what are the hyped up fears that are being piled on top of that reality in a way that calls into question an entire system that we need and that most of the time does work well, or at least well enough.
Emily, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Emily Bazelon is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and the Truman Capote Fellow at Yale Law School.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This election season, Trump has warned the electorate to fear a long list of things, including illegal immigrants, apocalypse at the hands of ISIS, and now, dead people voting.
They even want to try to rig the election at the polling booths. And believe me, there's a lot going on. People that have died 10 years ago are still voting.
What Trump's talking about is voter fraud, the keystone of his claims that the election will be rigged. But Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law and author of the book The Fight to Vote, says, don't worry.
In-person voter impersonation, which is what Trump is talking about, is vanishingly rare. One study for the Washington Post looked at 1 billion ballots cast over the past decade and found 31 documented examples of in-person voter impersonation.
Even before Trump started running his mouth, this bogeyman of voter fraud has been presented at least as a pretext to pass all sorts of voter ID laws.
We have on the books right now about 15 new laws in this election that would make it harder for many Americans to vote in one way or another for the first time since the Jim Crow era. And voter fraud has been used as the justification for these laws that really hit minority communities the hardest, that hit young people. And recently there were documents leaked from an investigation of Governor Scott Walker and his political operation around a judicial election. It was actually a campaign finance investigation. But in the middle of these documents, there's an email from one of his political aides to the other folk saying, well, it looks like this election isn't going to go so well for our candidate. Should we start claiming voter fraud now or wait till people actually vote? I say we start now. And they all write back, you know, some version of, you know, good idea. You know, over and over again, you hear these allegations and they evaporate upon contact with any investigation. But they're the pretext.
The notion of voter fraud was not invented out of whole cloth. There was a day back in the latter part of the 19th century when Tammany Hall, the great Boss Tweed political machine that essentially governed New York City, made pretty sure that everything was going to turn out just fine on election day.
Politicians have wanted to stuff the ballot box ever since senators wore togas. In the 20th century, Lyndon Johnson, winning his first Senate race when they, quote, discovered a box of votes cast in a southern Texas town called Alice, Texas, where 200 votes had been cast all for Lyndon Johnson in alphabetical order, and that was enough to win him the Senate. They called him Landslide Lyndon. There's always a risk of misconduct, but in all these instances, it was, in a sense, what we would call election fraud. It was not stray individual voters walking in and pretending to be someone else. It was the politicians or the people on the other side of the table stuffing the ballot box or rigging things. Even today, there are risks with voting machines, and there are greater risks with absentee ballot where you can't see the person casting the vote. But the specific thing that Donald Trump is railing against doesn't happen.
I noticed that Trump has homed in particularly on inner city Philadelphia, where he has said that the ghost voters are just going to be out of control. He did not mention the outlying western Philadelphia suburbs, which are also reliably blue, but also almost entirely white.
Rudy Giuliani, his surrogate, said explicitly, oh, this happens in the inner cities. And Trump has pointed to Philadelphia. And there's a not very far below the surface racial subtext to all of this. There's an interesting psychological study that was done a couple of years ago where members of the public were asked what their position was on something like voter ID laws. And they were shown a photograph of a voter. In some instances, the voter was black casting a vote and some white. And for white respondents, their support for voter ID laws went up when the photo was of a black person voting. We have a long, long and unfortunate history in our country of the racial divisions playing out in these election contexts. And this is going to go in the history books as one of those moments.
If increasing percentages of the electorate no longer have faith in the security and sanctity of the voting process, where does that leave us?
There have been fights over voting going back forever, but I can't think of a time, except maybe in the 1860 election of Abraham Lincoln, where one of the parties said, well, these results are not going to be legitimate and we're not going to necessarily accept them. Interestingly, you're seeing a number of Republican officials who run these elections in about 30 states say, no, it's not rigged. No, look, there really isn't a lot of voter fraud. I hope that's an inflection point because so many of those same officials have used that fear to justify laws that don't make sense. Maybe now we can all agree on those facts and then move on to better policies.
Michael, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Michael Waldman is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU and the author of The Fight to Vote. And so to summarize, people voting with fake licenses, not a thing. Trucking in illegal immigrants to flood polling stations, not a thing. Dead people voting, really not a thing. The election process being rigged, actually, kind of a thing. Not because of ballot box stuffing, but because of gerrymandering, the art of redrawing congressional districts in order to favor or screw one party over another.
The two key words are cracking and packing.
David Daley is publisher of the Connecticut Mirror and author of a new book on gerrymandering titled, we can't say the title on the air, but it rhymes with rat duct.
So cracking is the idea that you take the other party's vote and you divide it up so that it can be as ineffective as possible amongst as many districts as possible. And packing would be to take them and pack as many voters of one party as you can into as few seats as possible while taking the rest of the seats for yourself.
Which was pretty much business as usual for two centuries, with one party rigging the game in its favor whenever it got the chance, and the other party fighting to get it back. But according to Daley, that all changed after the Republicans were decimated in the 2008 election, and the art of gerrymandering became a science.
If you watch the back on the live television of that night, it sounds like Republicans are mourning that they're going to be a minority party for a long time. But there were a handful of really smart Republican strategists who realized this doesn't have to be the case. 2010 is a census year, which means it's a redistricting year, and they set about a state-by-state strategy to flip state legislative chambers in such a way that when state and congressional districts were drawn the next year, they would have the only voices in the room, the only seats at the table. And they pull this off brilliantly.
Now, if gerrymandering is a perversion of the framers' intent to maintain a balance every 10 years of one man, one vote, it's an equal opportunity perversion. Right now, the Republicans control 30-some state legislatures and therefore a disproportionate percentage of legislative districts and their shapes. But when the Democrats had the majority of state houses, they did approximately the same thing to give themselves safe seats, did they not?
Gerrymandering over the years has certainly been a bipartisan game. Both sides have done it for a long, long time. However, the difference here really is the technology. What you have right now is a program called Maptitude. It is an extremely powerful program. It comes preloaded with all of the census data, with all of the demographics and ethnicity and economic data you could possibly imagine. Then you can add on to that all of the public record data sets, voting records. You can add on to it a cloud's worth of consumer preferences, of magazine subscriptions, of zip code data. This wasn't the case in 2000. It wasn't the case in 1990. It certainly wasn't the case in 1810. A partisan map maker right now has so much information in front of them that they can draw lines that are essentially unbeatable for a decade.
Looking at gerrymandered legislative districts, you know, can be kind of a parlor game, or I don't know, it's like finding constellations. Oh, look, there's Sagittarius. Oh, look, it's Capricorn. Oh, look, it's the Michigan 14th.
There's one in Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania's 7th in the suburbs outside of Philadelphia, that is actually, it looks like Goofy kicking Donald Duck. I mean, it really, really does. And the only point that is essentially contiguous there is Goofy's foot and Donald Duck's rear end. And they are really funny. However, these district lines are the building blocks of democracy. And when they get as perverted and twisted as this, it leads to deeply undemocratic outcomes. In 2012, the Democrats got 1.4 million more votes than the Republicans and could not take control of the chamber. And when a gerrymander like this, for all intents and purposes, puts a chamber ostensibly intended to mirror popular opinion in the public will beyond control of the voters, that damages the levers of representative government. That is how elections are rigged. And that is the kind of rigged we ought to be talking about, not what Donald Trump is talking about.
I have to read a lot about electoral politics and have seen, you know, an endless amount of truth squatting and breathless reporting of various campaign outrages. And I've seen a lot of speculation about the fate of the Senate and the House. And yet I have read vanishingly little about legislative districts and how they're drawn and how they influence the House of Representatives and how over a period of 20 years, the GOP has stuck to its knitting and created these impregnable districts. Leading to the question, have we as an institution, the media, done our job explaining the civics of this to the American public?
No, we in the media have done a horrible job of explaining this. We still believe that gerrymandering is something that both sides do. We believe it is politics as usual. The game changed in 2010. Karl Rove went on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal in March of 2010, and he explained exactly what the Republican strategy was going to be. And yet, the New York Times can write story after story about will the Democrats take back the House and not even mention the words redistricting or gerrymandering. Because of the way congressional districts are drawn, Republicans have a powerful structural advantage, is the actual quote that the Times tends to use. And that, to me, is journalistic jujitsu. It's a sentence that's at once accurate, and yet it completely conceals the truth. When we do not talk about how this got that way, we are not telling people the actual honest story, which I think is a frankly journalistic malpractice. You don't have to take sides. You don't have to have your thumb on the scale. But you can't pretend that the lines don't matter. And who drew the lines matter.
Dave, many thanks.
Thank you, Bob. I really appreciate it.
David Daley is the publisher of the Connecticut Mirror and author of the book, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy.
This is On the Media.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone, with part four in our series, Busted, America's Poverty Myths. This time, it's the myth that America's social safety net, though imperfect, still is able to catch people in economic freefall before they slam the pavement. But there's no way to confront that myth without conveying how that sounds. So prepare yourself for the narrative equivalent of boom splat. You may have heard of GoFundMe, the crowdfunding platform where people donate money for projects or to help others in need. Even assuming that some of these campaigns are scams, the volume of heart-wrenching appeals from families ravaged by fires, floods, accidents, illness, and death itself is staggering.
A family still in shock and in need of help. A GoFundMe page has been set up to assist the family.
Caught in the crossfire, shot in the neck. Donations have been flooding in to reach their goal of $75,000.
Ashley Webb died from her injuries from a car crash. Now the family is trying to raise money for her funeral and medical bills by setting up a GoFundMe page.
Some appeals get media or go viral, most don't. Jody Spidell's GoFundMe page last year recounted how, after failing to secure public aid, she and her husband Randy, both in their mid-40s and ailing, lived all winter without heat and now lived without water on one meal a day. After no one responded to their online appeal, they put out their hungry cats, posted signs warning of carbon monoxide, hauled two charcoal grills into the bedroom, and died inhaling the fumes from the coals. The neighbor said, if we'd only known, we would have helped. How? Or more to the point, how much? How much would you? We don't know all the reasons the Spidells chose to die, but we do know that god-awful luck of the GoFundMe variety is pernicious, and that many people cope by engaging in a soul-sapping Sophie's Choice over where to spend those last few bucks, food or medicine, rent or gas to get to work. At some point, any one of us could be one of them.
64% of people don't have enough money to cover a $1,000 emergency expense should it arise.
Nearly half reported to a government survey that they'd struggle to come up with $400. $400.
It turns out that a number of Americans are touched by poverty during their lifetimes. In fact, the rate is exceedingly high.
Mark Rank, author of Chasing the American Dream, says the question is not whether we'll experience poverty, but when.
So our latest data indicates that between the ages of 25 and 60, nearly 40% of Americans will experience at least 1 year below the official poverty line, and 54% of Americans will experience below 150% of the poverty line.
Say you have some cash but need government aid to recover from a crisis. To qualify, you must contend with asset caps. Eight states have killed their caps, but more than half of them require aid recipients to limit their own assets to somewhere between $2,500 down to $1,000. In some places, you may be asked to cash in your college fund, possibly your IRA, and pay the penalty, and maybe sell your car if it's worth a lot, and then prove you did all that with reams of paperwork. If you screw up the paperwork, you could be out. If the state screws up your paperwork, you could be out. If GoFundMe comes through with some cash and you take it, you could be out.
This is my room.
This is where Damika Gilmore and her daughter sleep. Just a few blankets on the floor in Section 8 housing. But she isn't complaining.
Glad I'm not in the car freezing.
2 months earlier, Gilmore and her two kids lost their home because her daughter Tabby was being treated for bone cancer. It had already claimed one leg, and caring for her cost Gilmore her job. They did have food stamps with medical aid to pay for the chemo, but nothing to live on. So she launched a GoFundMe page.
341 people, most of them complete strangers, donating more than $15,000.
I was crying.
After telling her government caseworker, Gilmore was notified that if she kept that money, she'd lose her food and medical assistance, including the chemo coverage.
D'Amica could keep the money, pay for everything out of pocket until it's all gone, and then reapply for benefits. But she feels that defeats the purpose of people's generosity. That nest egg would go a long way toward filling your cupboards, getting her out of state-subsidized housing, and back in the workforce.
I don't know. It just doesn't make sense.
Tabby died last month, but Gilmore couldn't pay for the funeral because she'd been caring for her all that time, so the community launched a GoFundMe page to cover expenses and raised nearly $4,000. Since Tabby was no longer receiving disability, they were able to keep the money.
It has to do with a basic mistrust of people in poverty. If we were making policy based on data, our social safety net would look very different than the way that it does.
New America senior policy analyst Rachel Black.
It would catch people at a much higher level rather than imposing a level of destitution that makes it very challenging really for anybody to ascend out of. So we're not talking about data, we're talking about ideology.
I believe in a society where we help people who cannot help themselves, we help people when they're down on their luck, and we have an incentive-based system where people want to get up and make the most of their lives for themselves and their kids.
Congressman Paul Ryan in 2010.
We don't want to turn this safety net into a hammock that ends up lulling people into lives of dependency and complacency.
If you go get a job and you get 2 extra hours, you get your benefits cut because you're making too much money. It's an insane system, and that's where I agree with Paul Ryan. We have absolutely disincentivized people to be able to do anything with their lives.
Linda Tirado, who's experienced poverty much of her life, is author of Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America.
The problem isn't the welfare. The problem is the way with which we administer it. If we were worried about giving people what they needed to get back on their feet, if we were worried about giving people enough support that they could go be contributing members to society beyond their dead-end minimum wage job, we would be actually giving people money. We would be buying things that they need. The problem is that we need the tiniest modicum of compassion and generosity in a system that's set up so that we don't have people dying on the street like we do now. Yes, welfare is a failure, and it's because we've never trusted it and we've never done it properly.
I was wondering about the Spidells, who killed themselves after GoFundMe failed them. I couldn't find out much, except that they'd lived in Bellefontaine, Ohio, which was the setting for the 1934 film The Old Fashioned Way, in which W.C. Fields famously juggles. 1934 was the year of one of the worst storms of the Dust Bowl, the year lawmen gunned down John Dillinger and Bonnie and Clyde. Unemployment was falling, but the Depression would drag on another 8 years. As for W.C. Fields, he started out in vaudeville as a genteel tramp who juggled. I was thinking how that character might resonate, even today, with so many people struggling to keep a roof over their heads by keeping a lot of balls in the air. Matthew Desmond, author of Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, says that during the Depression, people were evicted by the hundreds. Now it's by the millions.
Evictions used to be rare in this country. You know, they used to draw crowds. But we've reached a point today where the majority of poor renting families are spending most of what they have on housing costs. And 1 in 4 of those families are spending over 70% just on rent and utilities. You don't need to make a huge mistake. You don't need to have a big emergency to invite an eviction. Something very small can do it.
Or something very big. So get ready for that boom splat I mentioned at the top. The sound of someone crashing through the safety net.
Hello. You can come on in.
Recorded here at the YWCA Family Center, a clean and orderly homeless shelter in Columbus, Ohio.
My name is Margaret Smith, and I have 6 children, 5 boys and 1 girl. The reason I ended up in the shelter is because My son was shot outside of our house.
How old is he?
He's 17. He knew the girl. He used to date her, and he didn't want to be with her anymore. She came with some guys, and they shot my son 6 times. He's like, Mom, help me. I feel like I'm about to die. I said, you're not going to die on me today. All the kids were sitting there. They were watching. I'm seeing this blood, good shot of his neck. So I grabbed a blanket, put it around his neck, put a knot in it. I told my 15-year-old daughter, I said, I need you to put your hands right here and apply pressure to his neck. My 11-year-old went to get a pillow off the couch to elevate his head. He said, Sissy, keep talking to me. Talk to me. Talk to me. The ambulance finally got there. As he's in ICU fighting for his life, I go home 3 days later. I go to the landlord to pay the rent. She tells me, did you get the eviction notice? I said, what eviction notice? She said, well, you have a 3-day eviction notice. So I called the attorney that was over the property. What I did was made a mutual decision to leave in 45 days, but I let him know that I can't leave in 3 because I'm still at the hospital.
You had violated your agreement in their view because you had committed a crime? It wasn't for lack of payment. It was because
a crime was committed on the property, but it wasn't the people that lived in the property that committed the crime. He was a victim. So I ended up in the shelter. I lost my job. I worked as a customer rep for Southern Connecticut Gas, the gas company. They couldn't hold my position. They had me go through Aetna to see if they would get it approved under disability. They denied it. So they couldn't hold my position for the 4 weeks I needed to take care of my son. So they terminated me. So not only did I lose my place, I lost my job, and I ended in the shelter. And not only that, all my kids are spread out different places. My son is still healing. He still had nurses, physical therapy, and it's just breaking my heart that I can't be with my kids.
Where are they?
My son is at my mother's. My daughter is at her aunt's. And my other son is at a cousin's. And I have the 2 youngest ones with me here. It's just been a nightmare. I've been trying to find places. But every time I go to the place, they ask, well, how are you going to continue to pay the rent? I'm going to go to work and pay the rent like any other normal person would do. Just right now, my main focus is getting my children back together in the house. Me and my family were a victim of a crime. So why should we lose everything because of what someone else created for us? It's not fair.
Tell me about your kids.
My oldest son, Deswan, he's a diabetic. He's 23. Very good kid. He helps me with the children while I work. My other son, Raymond Cook, is the one that was shot. He was 17 years old. Every morning, he would get the kids off to school, which was down the street from my house, and then he would go to school. So by him being in the hospital, that was ruined because I didn't have the kids in daycare because I felt like I had enough older kids we could pull together and make this work. So everything was just all screwed up. My 15-year-old is my daughter, Tierra Cook, straight honor roll student, plays basketball. She wants to be a lawyer when she grow up. She's trying to get a scholarship. My 11-year-old, his name is Zalon Smith. He is so supportive. When I was at the shelter in our room, I just broke down crying. And he grabbed me, and he said, Mommy, it's going to be okay. And he put my big head on his little shoulder.
You see, with some skillful juggling, she'd maintained a stable, if fragile, life for her family. But a lethal ex-girlfriend swept in like a hurricane and blew it apart. Margaret has health insurance for the kids and food stamps, but no money. There's a lifetime limit on cash assistance of 60 months, and Margaret had used it all up. Many years ago, when her father died, she required long treatment to overcome a suicidal depression. Later, she had diverticulitis. Then she had to have a mass in her throat surgically removed. Then a hip replacement. She needs another one, but obviously that'll have to wait. Now she has to get all those balls back up in the air.
I got to get my kids out of here. We done came a long way from the projects to me moving, living on my own the last 7 years, paying regular rent. I didn't never want to go back to the projects. I lived there all my life. That project will destroy, especially young men. You don't have a chance. You got people that's in the gang over here. It'll swallow your kids up. I had to go. But it came to my house. So this is what I say to people, even people that's got money and power, don't walk around with your head up high. Some people look at you like, oh, you're beneath me, you're this, you're that, but I'm still a person, I have a heart. I have ambitions, I might not have got there yet, but I'm working towards it. You treat people how you want to be treated, whether they have a dollar in their pocket, a penny, or you a millionaire, because you never know when it's your turn. Anything can happen. You might be on top of the world tomorrow, but it can end for you the next day. And you'll go through poverty what we're going through.
James Baldwin once observed, "Anyone who has ever struggled with poverty knows how extremely expensive it is to be poor. If you're poor, you pay more for public transit because you can't afford a monthly pass, or you rely on old cars that break down and cost more to fix while paying gas prices that have outrun your wages. You pay more for car insurance because of where you live. You pay more for rent than your place is worth. If you're poor, you're unlikely to eat healthy meals because healthy food costs an average of $45 more a month, tough on a minimum wage. You can't buy any food cheaply because it costs more in poor neighborhoods, and without spare cash, you can't even save by buying in bulk. You're less likely to have a bank account because of soaring fees and penalties. You cash checks at places that take a cut. You also pay a higher percentage of your income in state and local taxes than the rest of us do." And so on. It's death by a thousand cuts and no way to staunch the bleeding. As Baldwin wrote, "One's feet have simply been placed on the treadmill forever."
You are 30 by now, and nothing you have done has helped you to escape the trap. But what is worse than that is that nothing you have done, and as far as you can tell, nothing you can do, will save your son or your daughter from meeting the same disaster and possibly coming to the same end.
If we accepted that the problems are systemic, that millions of people would not be falling into the same patterns if those incentives weren't there, if those paths weren't cleared for them, if that wasn't the way society ran, right? If we accepted that, then we would have to accept our own complicity.
Linda Tirado.
We would have to accept that our home mortgage tax deductions are coming off of the back of a family that could use an extra 20 cents for food stamps that month, that some college student somewhere is living in poverty because they can't access programs because we want our tax deductions and we want our stuff.
Athens County, Ohio, Appalachian country, has 6% unemployment. And yet more than 30% of people living below the poverty line because they work mostly part-time minimum wage jobs. And they drive a long way to get and keep those jobs.
You know, you got literally a million or more people driving around without a driver's license because they can't afford car insurance.
Former Athens County Welfare Director Jack Freck drove me across his old turf.
And of course, that throws them into the whole legal system. They owe fines, they owe reinstatement fees, money that they could never come up with. And essentially making them criminals because they're too poor to drive a car, which they have to do if they're going to keep a job, you know. So, you know, we put poor people in these situations that are totally untenable.
Just 16% of the poor here get food stamps, which in any case are designed to cover only 3/4 of a family's needs. So most families run out before the end of the month. That puts a lot of pressure on local food pantries, like Friends and Neighbors Community Food Center in Coolville, population 500, which serves 1,000 meals a week. Stacks of used clothing are laid out on tables, shelves of lamps and plates, a random selection of appliances and knickknacks, filling a large, light room. The food is in the back. All you have to do is ask.
If you have a need, and I find out about it, I'm going to see what I can do to help you. no matter what it is. It doesn't matter.
Connie Elick used to be a customer at the pantry, but now she manages the place since the founder, Lisa Roberts, died earlier this year. But before Lisa died, she hit upon another need that no one else had thought to fill.
We have 13 acres, so we designated an acre to an open cemetery. Lisa wanted to be buried there, but she also knew there were people in the area that could not afford a funeral or a cemetery plot. We will bury him here for nothing.
GoFundMe is filled with people desperately seeking money to bury their dead. In England, this is called funeral poverty, and it's agonizing.
And in the last 5 years, I've buried a husband, my grandson, my son, and helped bury a friend. Yeah, it is something that's really needed, and it's wonderful that she did that.
Lottie Lawson is time-worn and frail. She said her husband's insurance almost covered his burial back in West Virginia, but she still can't afford a tombstone, and the deaths of her son and grandson were totally unexpected. She told me funerals cost over $7,000.
And you have to pay and pay, then you have to do without something else. It's been really rough. It was great to come out here and know that that week, you know, you're going to be all right because you're going to have food.
Connie says that Lisa hit upon the idea of the Friends and Neighbors Cemetery when a young man who worked for her husband, Kenny, lost his mom. The young man was poor, so Kenny made the coffin.
It was satin-lined. It was beautiful. The hearse was our Friends and Neighbors van. And the burial is at one of their friends' home. That way, there was no cost to them. Lisa did her makeup, her hair, dressed her. But there's a funny part to that story, if you can find that funny. Lisa's mother was in the hospital, and they had stored this lady in Lisa's mother's house until the burial. So when they went to pick up Lisa's mother at the hospital, they had her in the back of the van. We're talking redneck American country here. And they do things like that.
People in extremity often do things that don't make sense to people who aren't. Matthew Desmond, author of Evicted, learned that up close when he spent 5 months in a trailer park on the edge of Milwaukee that housed the white poor, and then 9 months in the inner city where the black poor lived.
Lorraine was my neighbor in the trailer park, and she was spending over 70% of her income to live in a place the city considered an environmental biohazard at the time.
A 54-year-old grandmother, she loved mystery novels and So You Think You Can Dance. Her trailer, though toxic, was tidy. And that 70% of her income she spent on housing? About a quarter of all renters below the poverty line do. That left her with $5 a day. Eventually, she was evicted, but she'd skip rent and other basics to pay for cable and pricey face creams. She riled her kin and her pastor, who said she was poor because she threw her money away. Desmond says the reverse was more true. She threw her money away because she was poor. Once she spent her entire monthly allotment of food stamps on lobster tails, shrimp, crab's legs, salad, and lemon meringue pie, which she ate alone in a single sitting.
You know, I was angry. I was confused. I didn't understand how I would write about something like that. But Lorraine didn't apologize for it. She was celebrating an anniversary, you know, of her late boyfriend. She wanted to do something special on that day. And she made me realize that my job isn't to apologize for her behavior or to hide it. It's to try to understand it. And the way I understood it was like, look, if you're someone like Lorraine that's giving most of what you have to live in a rundown trailer, you know, and you are so far below just stable poverty, right?
Stable poverty means paying the rent, keeping the lights on, having enough food to live on. That's it. She wasn't even close.
You know, just giving her some sort of stability and certainty about the world. That was such a heavy lift in her life that no amount of scrimping or saving could have lifted her there. And so if you're Lorraine, what do? You know, you pepper the suffering with color. I think that writing about that is something that we need to do because there's these two ways to dehumanize people. One is to cleanse people of all virtue, and the other is to remove all sin from their lives.
the safety net is working. Last year, it helped lift 38 million people out of poverty. Without government assistance, poverty would be twice as high. We've increased our investment steadily since President Johnson launched his war on poverty, but it neglects the people who need it most. If you earn a wage that puts you at or 50% above the poverty line, the U.S. willingly and increasingly lightens your load with vital income enhancers. Despite your pitiful paycheck, you can keep a roof over your head, usually. But if you live in deep poverty, 50% below the line, say you're a single jobless adult or a single mother who can't find work and manage childcare, the safety net is gossamer, a cobweb. And that's over 19 million people. Current policy is based on the premise that the poor require different treatment than we who are not poor, because they are different. They're not. They love their kids. They crave a life with dignity. They hate poverty. There are ways to fix the safety net, but we have to understand what it is we're fixing, and it's not poor people. It's a system that is indisputably designed, engineered. Oh, the hell with it. Rigged. Busted, America's Poverty Myths, is produced by Meera Sharma and Eve Claxton and edited by Katya Rogers. This series is produced in collaboration with WNET in New York as part of Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity in America. Major funding for Chasing the Dream is provided by the JPB Foundation, with additional funding from the Ford Foundation.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Paige Cowett, Michael Loewinger, and Sara Kari. We had more help from Leah Fetter. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.